me with some pleasure that one of her daughters had sent a lovely long letter asking Rose to visit her in England. "But wouldn't a ticket be very expensive?" I asked, worried that she might not realize how much a plane ticket cost. Rose smiled and told me that her daughter would pay for the ticket. "But tell me now, what other errand did you have in Shaletown?" Rose asked, with sudden curiosity. I glanced at Harrison, who'd put the phone away. He said, "We've been trying to find out about a private school that used to be here in Shaletown." "The Boys' Academy, in Carmine Street?" Rose asked. We both stared at her, and I thought what a fool I was not to realize that of course she would know about the school. Shaletown was relatively small, after all, and she had lived here for a long time. "I remember when it opened. It was called Shaletown Institute. Oh, and a grim place it was back then, with very serious ideas about discipline. It closed down for a time, and then it was opened up as the Shaletown Boys' Academy, and set out to target wealthy families with problem sons. It was run along very military lines to start with, but then the management changed, and the school seemed to go through a sort of renaissance. Instead of fierce, exhausting sports, the boys were introduced to the arts, music in particular. There were a great many concerts in those days, and it was a real pleasure to attend them. In the end, the place became rather a model school." "But it burned down," Harrison said. Rose sighed. "Yes, I remember thinking at the time what a pity it was." "Why didn't they rebuild, if it was so successful?" Harrison asked. "There must have been insurance." "There was a great deal of damage to the school buildings, but I think it was more that there seemed no heart to rebuild. You see, one of the music teachers, actually, the man who had really been responsible for the school's renaissance, died in the fire. A terrible tragedy it was." She sighed. "Someone told us there was a fire in the bakery," I said. Rose blinked at the abrupt change of subject. "Yes, but that was quite recent. A completely senseless bit of arson, according to the police. It seems to me that half the crimes committed these days are senseless."
"Is there any talk about who might have done it?" Harrison asked, a bit too eagerly.
Before Rose could answer, there was the sound of a horn from outside. I explained quickly about Raoul, so Rose would not think him rude. "Have you done anything about visiting another refugee?" I asked, when we were in the tiny entrance hall, pulling on our damp outer clothes. Davy's sighs, making it even more cramped.
"I'm ashamed to say that I haven't yet," Rose admitted. "Oh, I've visited just randomly a few times, but I can't seem to bring myself to form a closer connection again. Perhaps it's the misery of the poor people in there, but I feel so terribly affected by it. I have been talking all this time about hatred and how it affected my life. But, you know, sadness can wound you too, in which case that place is full of wounded people, and when you go there, you're wounded too." She shook her head. "Oh, goodness me, how garrulous I'm becoming. Off you go now, and Davy, you'll show them the way. He knows it very well," she added reassuringly to me. Then she gave me a hug and told me to come and visit again with my young man. I blushed and didn't dare to look at Harrison, which caused Rose's sharp eyes to narrow speculatively, so that I was quite glad to get out into the rain and the wind again. But when we were all squashed in the car, I saw that Harrison looked unperturbed and realized that her teasing would probably mean no more to him than kissing me had done. I felt rather aggrieved that I had made so little impression on him, yet I ought to be glad that his kiss and my reaction to it hadn't marred our friendship. Raoul greeted Davy, who said confusedly, "Davy came so he could show you the way." Then he proceeded to point out the way to the industrial estate, where he said he had his caravan. I guessed Raoul had looked up the industrial estate on the map, but he obeyed Davy's directions meticulously, and I was touched by his consideration. The industrial estate lay beyond the straggling residential edge of the town, over a stretch of barren hill paddocks. Davy pointed out a cluster of enormous warehouse roofs rising above the crest of the slight hill, saying he lived past them. When we reached the top of the hill, we saw the whole industrial estate spreading out, mostly to the right of the warehouses. The road we were on brought us to the left of the warehouses, then curved around and up,
so that we came back towards the warehouses from the other direction. They looked even bigger, rising so massively above the shabby clutter of little shacks and sheds that made up the rest of the industrial estate. Most of them looked to be closed up and half derelict. Then Davy cried out that Raoul should turn into a driveway leading to a small grey timber office shack with a dribble of smoke coming from its stack. It was surrounded by a herd of half-rusted and disassembled relics that might once have been cars, and there was a sign on the post that said, Dolan Spare Parts. Under it, so faded that it was barely discernible, was Scrap Metal Supplies. I wondered if Davy still operated the business. His blackened hands seemed to suggest it, but how could he make a living from this run-down business when it looked as if all the other businesses around it had failed? Then I realized Davy was probably on some sort of disability payment.
Davy lives in the caravan out the back, Davy said cheerfully. You park here.
Raoul pulled up in front of the shack as he had been directed, and Harrison and I got out to let Davy out. It was still raining, but not as heavily as before. Davy went round to say thank you to Raoul and shake his hand.
I'm sorry, Davy, I can't get out because...
Raoul began.
Davy knows. Legs no good. Davy once had a cat with legs that didn't work. They shot that cat, and Davy cried.
I guess he was a good cat, Raoul said gently, as if there was no hurry, though the rain saturated his shoulder and wet his cheeks.
Davy loved that cat, Davy said sadly.
Then he seemed to cheer up.
Simon says, go that way now.
He was pointing in the direction of the warehouses.
Thank you, Davy, Raoul said. Maybe we'll see you again sometime.
Oh, yes, you will, Simon says, Davy told him.
He tapped the hood of the car with his black finger.
You got something in there needs replacing. That'll be a good reason to come back. Davy will get a new one for when it breaks.
He pumped Raoul's hand again with his huge black hand, then Harrison's, but when he came to me, his smile faded. He looked at me with his guileless blue eyes, his sweet, unplaceable scent filling the air.
You gotta be careful here, Alizon White Star. This is one of their places, and they're stronger in their own places.
Then he turned and trotted over to the hut, waving once more before he entered. Harrison had got into the car, and I followed, trying to shake the unease that Davy's nonsense had made me feel.
Did he just tell you that you should be careful? Harrison asked me. I shrugged and shook myself.
It's probably just what people tell him all the time because he's simple, and he thinks that's just how you say goodbye.
Raoul started up the engine and drove back onto the road, the headlights picking up little more than the rain slanting down. He headed for the warehouses, saying the road probably looped back to the main road, but a few minutes later he came to a dead end, a cul-de-sac with the enormous metal warehouses on all sides.
Raoul began to turn the car.
Davy said to go this way. Poor guy probably just meant the town was over this way.
There was not much space, so we had to go back and forth a few times to turn. I was wondering how trucks could get in there when Harrison let out a cry that startled Raoul so much he stalled.
What on earth did you...
Raoul began, but then he stopped because he could see, as I did, that Harrison was staring in disbelief out the window. We both followed his gaze to a warehouse door with a security light angled towards it. It looked no different from any of the other warehouses around us, and I looked at Harrison in puzzlement.
Look at the name above the door, Harrison said. It's the name of the guy you said was married to Aaron Reese's wife, Raoul, the first husband.
Second, Raoul corrected. And you're right. Machiaros Incorporated. This must be one of the properties he left her.
It's on the other warehouses, too, I said, squinting back through the rain.
In fact, it turned out to be on all of the warehouses, because Harrison insisted on getting out and looking.
What an odd coincidence that we should just come on them like that, Harrison said, as we were driving back along the road.
35. On the way home, Harrison questioned Raoul about his visit to Aaron Race's office. It was still raining steadily, and the wipers were on high.
Mrs. Race was definitely a wealthy woman before she got involved with Race, Raoul was saying.
The office is the top floor of the highest building in Shaletown, with gold-tinted glass windows and a foyer that would not be out of place in New York or some other major city. I know from my internet search that Makarios practically made a religion of keeping business in your own backyard, but the building seemed overdone. I commented on it to the woman who spoke with me. I was told that the man who built it, no name, but she meant Makiaros, believed that Shaletown had the potential to be a major industrial city. I suppose that's why he had so many warehouses built, not that anyone mentioned them. Other than the showiness of the office, the only other thing I noticed was the amount of electronics security in the building, but it was very low-key. I doubt I would have noticed if I hadn't been looking. Why would a charitable organization want so much security? They must be hiding something, Harrison said. It might just be more grandiose planning on Makiaros's part, Raoul said. Did the woman say anything about what Race Incorporated does? I asked curiously. Not specifically. Apparently neither Race Incorporated nor its international associate Orba operate in the same areas as such organizations as Oxfam, World Vision, and Community Aid Abroad. Their interest is in trying to change society so that the sorts of things these other groups fund would cease to exist. I said that I thought this was admirable, though ambitious, but that I was definitely interested if I could be convinced that a donation of mine would affect some specific and concrete change for good in the world. The woman who spoke with me suggested I meet with someone more senior, who could explain some of their projects to me. I said I was a busy man, and we left it at that, but I don't have any doubt they'll contact me. But now it's your turn. Tell me what you learned about Harlan Sanderson's old school. I left it to Harrison, and my attention drifted, lulled by the sound of the rain and the rhythmic slap, slap of the wipers. Raoul summed up what he had been told. So, Harlan Sanderson went to a school which was destroyed by an explosion that killed an inspirational teacher who had created an enlightened and nurturing program for delinquent boys. There is a rumor that the explosion was not an accident, but we don't have any real proof that it was the work of a gang, or even that this bakery fire was the work of a gang. In fact, it sounds as if your Mrs. Cobb herself doubts that a gang even exists. I roused myself to say that the woman in the bus shelter had mentioned a Shaletown gang. That still could be a rumor, Raoul said. I wonder if it would be possible to track down a teacher who worked at the academy. It oughtn't to be that difficult. I have a friend in the education department. It wasn't until we were close to home that Raoul mentioned the journal, saying he had read part of it, but wanted to finish it if I would let him keep it for a while longer. He suggested that I come to his place for dinner with the others the following night, and he would return it then. Just one thing puzzles me. It was Professor Kirk. That made me smile, and when I told him, he laughed too. You never know what doors you are going to go through in your life, do you? He asked softly, glancing down at his useless legs. Raoul insisted on dropping me at my own door before he took Harrison home, because it was still raining hard. I told him I would be fine catching the bus, but getting out of the warm car into the cold, wet evening, I was very glad to know that a warm kitchen and a hot shower were only a few steps away. They were pretty wet steps, though, because so much rain had fallen that the drain was overflowing and the back and front steps were underwater. After one sodden step into the path, which had gritty black water flowing into my shoe, I stepped sideways onto the grass. The ground was so saturated that my weight caused a stream of black mud to squirt up onto the front of my jeans. I groaned. There was no one in the kitchen as I entered, though the room smelled of cooking and was very warm. No baby monitor either, which meant that Jesse had the monitor in his room and Mum and Luke were sleeping. Dar's absence meant he was in the shed, since the van was parked in the drive. I went upstairs to have a bath, glad there was no one to wonder why I wasn't in school uniform. Miranda's bedroom was dark, so she must be out with Ricky, and when I went in to get some dry clothes, there was no light and no serenity. I was beginning to shiver now, despite the fact that the house was warm, so I filled the bath, and in 10 minutes I was neck-deep in hot water. I sank down into it and dozed in sheer mindless pleasure for a while. But eventually, I found myself thinking about Shaletown Boys Academy and what it meant that Harlan had gone to a school for wealthy delinquents. He had to have known the music teacher, and he had to have been there when the boiler exploded. I didn't know what sort of music the teacher had offered his troubled students, but I found myself imagining classical music, Mozart, Brahms, and Vivaldi. It occurred to me with a chill that the sickness Harlan carried would not have liked the teacher, because it sounded as if, like Da, he had a habit of lifting and strengthening the people around him. And what had happened to all those boys who had been inspired by him? Had they simply gone to other schools, as Harlan had done? A chill crept into the bath, or maybe it was coming from inside me, because I was thinking what a perfect place Shale Town Boys Academy must have been for a sickness that preyed on wounded spirits. A home for delinquent boys, many of whom must have felt bruised or battered. And then along had come the music teacher, lifting those same boys and inspiring them. If the sickness had made Harlan get his friends to burn down Jilly's house just because she'd got in the way of his pursuit of me, what would it do to remove someone like the music teacher? Could it have prompted Harlan to set up an accident to get the music teacher permanently out of the way? I told myself I was going too far. After all, the explosion had closed the school down. The sickness could not have wanted that. Suddenly, Miranda hammered on the door, saying that dinner was nearly ready. I got out and scurried to the bedroom to dress, to find Serenity laid out on her bed. I felt a moment of nervousness that she might somehow have noticed my absence from school, but she did not look at me or in any way acknowledge that I was in the room. I wanted badly to tell her what I knew about the poetry group and what I suspected they intended for her, but what could I say that would not make me sound like a nutcase? She would sneer at me and dismiss what I said. Worse, she might even say something about her crazy sister to one of the people running the group. And maybe they would say something to the gang in Shale Town, who would in turn speak to Harlan. And what would the sickness make him do then? I went downstairs, thinking I could do nothing until I could prove that the poetry group and the people behind it meant Serenity harm. And I didn't know how I could ever find proof that would mean anything to Serenity, or even to Da. Miranda and I were serving out the spinach quiche Jessie had made when the phone rang. It was one of the members of Miranda's jazz group. She abandoned me and began discussing the playlist for a party where they were to perform. Jessie took over serving the quiche and passed me Luke's bowl of mush. I spooned it into him absently, making faces to distract him when he looked like getting bored with the concept of dinner. I had just finished feeding him when Da came in the back door, shaking his head a little. I thought he looked tired. "Bad pupil?" Jessie asked, curiously. Da laughed. "Brilliant pupil. No talent." He sighed. "It ought to be that when a person works hard and is dedicated, that brilliance is his just reward. But talent is capricious, and it can appear in the lazy as well as the dedicated. But how to tell someone, prepared to give their soul, that it won't be enough?" There was a knock at the back door, and before Da could turn back to open it, Rona Wojciech burst in, clad in painfully bright fluorescent orange and green stripes, complaining bitterly about the wet path, as if we had watered it just to spoil her lime suede boots. Da sent Miranda up to get Mum and poured Rona a glass of red wine. She grimaced after tasting it, but still drank it pretty fast. I retreated upstairs with my dessert, feeling only slightly guilty, because Rona really was bad for digestion. So I sat on my bed to eat the stewed plums, listening to rain pattering against the window and the distant spikes of Rona's voice. I was lying back, drowsing, when I heard Rona leave, but I was too warm and lazy to go down. I roused myself enough to peel off my jeans and slide under the covers. It was so nice just lying there, listening to the rain and the muted noises of the house, that I drifted off pretty soon. I dreamed of Davy, the mechanic, riding on the back of a dog the size of a small elephant. As in the previous dream, the slow gentleness of his expression had given way to an alertness that made him look like a different person, despite the fact that in all other ways he looked like Davy. He called to me to climb up behind, saying I could travel with him. But I told him rather sharply that I couldn't. He quirked his brow sardonically and said I could do more than I knew, and then he laughed. I woke with the sound of his laughter in my ears, and a vivid memory of the queer thing Davy had said to me after we had given him a lift home. "You got to be careful here, Alizon, White Star. This is one of their places, and they're stronger in their own places." It had seemed nonsense at the time, but the more I thought about his words, the more ominous they seemed. But I told myself it was just the way my subconscious was expressing my general unease and anxiety these days. Just before I had got out of Raoul's car, we had arranged to meet up at his place the following night to discuss what we had learned that day. I was glad, because I really wanted to talk over what we had been told about Shale Town Boys Academy. Serenity's alarm went off, and through slitted eyes, I watched her get up and dress. Her face in the dim morning light looked tired, which meant she'd probably sat late for Mum the previous night. I had no memory of her coming to bed. When she went out, I heard Mum call out to ask her if she would sit again that night, and my extended hearing caught her dull-voiced agreement. I marveled that Mum, who seemed so switched off from the world, could have the uncanny knack of knowing who was in the hall outside her studio. By the time I got down, Serenity had left, and Miranda was feeding Luke and moaning because she couldn't find something. Dar came in from his run, saying that it was as wet as hell everywhere, but at least the rain had stopped. Miranda lifted Luke from his chair and put him into Dar's arms, and Dar put him back in the chair. The physical handover of Luke was a tradition dating back to a time when he'd been left on the grass in his bouncy chair for over 2 hours, with each of us thinking that someone else was taking care of him. Luckily, he'd been under a tree in the shade, but we were all horrified when Dar came in with him, crying his eyes out, poor little mite. These days the rule was that you physically handed him to the person who was to be in charge of him next. That way, you could never be in doubt about who was supposed to be watching over him. Dar asked where Jessie was, and Miranda, hurrying through the kitchen and muttering to herself as she flicked through sheets of music, said irritably that he had been in the shower for so long that she hadn't had time to wash her hair. She slammed the door when she went out. "Maybe she's about to change colours again," I said. Dar laughed and nuzzled Luke, who responded by kissing him extravagantly, smearing him with Weet-Bix in the process. "Ugh," Dar laughed, "just what I needed." I was about to leave too, when I remembered to tell him I was going to dinner at Raoul's that night with Jilly and Harrison. "Can I get a lift home after, if I ring?" "I've got a late rehearsal tonight for a gig, but maybe Jessie can do it." Dar looked at Jessie, who'd just come in, and he nodded. "A gig with Losing the Rope?" I asked, switching my attention back to Dar. He shook his head. "It's with those guys I met at the last gig, Neo Tokyo. They've asked me to guest with them in a show called The Big Sleep. Funny name for a gig, but it's supposed to be quite big."
"Geez, Dar," Jessie said. "Even I've heard of The Big Sleep. It's going to be huge. More than 2,000 people in a field with a gigantic stage that will be especially built for it."
2,000? Can that be right?" Dar asked.
Jessie shrugged.
"The same crew did a similar thing last year called The Big Eat. 2,000 expected, but 3 turned up. There's more than one band. It's for charity, right?"
Dar nodded. "Aaron Race said there would be a number of bands. We'll play one of the last slots before the night winds up. I didn't realize it would be so big an audience, though. Well, it doesn't make any difference, really."
"Neo Tokyo, a rap, you said," Jessie commented, reaching out to take Luke from Dar. "I didn't think that was your thing."
"Rap is not as attractive as some other music is to me," Dar admitted. "But that's because a lot of it is so raw. The lyrics are simplistic and defensive as opposed to being provocative. But these Neo Tokyo guys have an interesting approach, and they're superb musicians."
I had to ask. "Da, how come Aaron Race keeps organizing things for you? I mean, what does he get out of it?"
Da studied my face, which felt as if it was sullen.
"Alizon, I'm afraid I've given you the wrong impression of Aaron Race. I started out feeling uncomfortable about him wanting me to work without Losing the Rope, but last weekend I had a good talk to him, and I realized that he only suggested working with other bands so that I could stretch myself as a musician. He's actually been incredibly supportive of me ever since he suggested Losing the Rope for that Urban Dingo gig. He doesn't get anything out of helping me or anyone else, except that he likes doing it. And that's a good thing in a world where just about everything is for sale. So, you see, I'd be pretty ungrateful to be letting my daughter harbour bad feelings about him. You know how rare it is that someone like this comes along in the life of a musician? Someone who can really make a difference?
Make a difference how? I wanted to ask, darkly, but I didn't. I think he likes manipulating people, I added, rather primly.
Dar smiled. And you think he's playing chess with me? To what end?
Well, that's the big question, isn't it? I said, thinking of what Harrison had said. Maybe he just likes the power.
Dar shook his head. Oh, Alison, that might be the motivation of a character in a book or in some Hollywood movie. Real people's motives are far more complex. There are always layers to our decisions and actions that even we can't read. And think about this. There were artists of all kinds I met during the 3 days I've just done, and none of them had a bad word to say about Aaron. They all talked about how helpful he had been. Many of them only got a break because of him using his influence on their behalf.
It sounds too good to be true, Jesse said.
Dar grinned.
Never look a gift horse in the mouth. Besides, it wasn't Aaron's idea that I do this job. The Neo-Tokyo guys asked me off their own bat. Aaron doesn't really have a lot to do with the big sleep. His focus on that night will be a private, invitation-only parallel event. The great thing is that we'll get paid on the night, and the fee will cover Zambia's gallery opening, and leave enough for me to finally get some emergency money socked away.
I thought that was what the last gig was for, I said.
The money won't come in for a bit, and Miranda needs a new instrument.
I would have said what I thought about Miranda's desire for a new saxophone when her old one was perfectly fine. Then I caught sight of the clock. I managed to get to the bus stop in time by giving myself a stitch and dropped into a seat, clutching at my side and puffing hard. Serenity had got on too. How had Miranda made the earlier bus when Serenity had missed it? I wondered. Maybe she'd gone for a walk. Of course, I couldn't ask. Anyway, she'd taken a seat at the very back of the bus. I felt her eyes on me and wished I could just go back and speak with her. But the gulf between us was a great deal more than could be bridged by a walk from one end of the bus to the other.
36.
The school day dragged, as if every minute was shaped out of treacle. What made it worse was that Jilly did not come to school again. I wanted to call her at lunchtime, but the class before ended up with a long detention, and when I raced to the public phone in the few minutes remaining afterwards, I found someone had cut the cord. Then, when I got back to school, the duty teacher spotted me, wrote my name down for going out of the grounds without a permission slip, and gave me a detention. It was that kind of day. The only good thing was that I managed again to successfully avoid Harlan by hiding shamelessly in the classrooms, avoiding the lockers, and because of the detention.
"You're late," Harrison said, when I arrived at Raoul's place.
"Detention," I said wearily. "Is Jilly here?"
"She was here when I got here," Harrison said, and ushered me to the kitchen, where Jilly and Raoul were sitting with her hands wrapped around mugs of chocolate.
Jilly looked pale, and her eyes were red as if she'd been crying.
"Jilly, what's wrong?" I asked.
She got to her feet, and her lovely sea scent enveloped me as she hugged me.
"I couldn't go today," she said. "Harrison told me what you think about Harlan and the fire."
"I felt like she ought to know," Harrison said, apologetically.
"I'm so sorry," I told Jilly, feeling my eyes prick with tears.
"No," she said, sniffing hard.
"You're not to be sorry, because how could this be your fault? In a way, it's not even Harlan's fault. It's this thing inside him, this sickness. That's the enemy."
Raoul suddenly set his mug down firmly and said,
"There's something I need to show you, Alison."
He turned his chair and wheeled out of the kitchen, leaving us to follow him. Jilly and Harrison exchanged puzzled looks that told me they had no idea of what we were to see either. Instead of going right to the back of the house, Raoul wheeled through the last door before the end of the hall into an enormous lounge room lined with floor-to-ceiling bookshelves. The only furnishings on the creamy carpet were two long pale curves of modular sofa and a big square coffee table made of white wood. On the few bits of wall left bare, there were more of the black and white photographs, showing winter-bare trees framed in the same wood as the coffee table. The books and three identical stacks of blue cushions set at regular intervals along a deeply recessed windowsill provided the only color in the room. Through the window, I saw a Japanese maple growing out of an intricate swirl of bricks. Raoul had wheeled to a desk, set up in the midst of the bookshelves, where there was another computer and a few other pieces of equipment. I went over to stand behind him with the others as he booted up the computer, then turned his chair to look at us.
"I could have sorted my other system out by now, but I want Daisy to look at it," he said, seeing my face. "Anyway, I was working on this new one this morning when an invitation arrived from Race Incorporated, inviting me to an Orba fundraising event at Castle Dean Estate. I opened it here and then responded by email. Confirmation came back almost at once with the same logo as on the invitation, and I don't know why, but I started fiddling to see if I could decode the image." He turned back to the screen and tapped on a file on the desktop, and then we were looking at the digitized logo I had first seen on Aaron Race's card. "Now watch," Raoul said, and he began tapping at the keyboard. "This is a simulation of what I did with the image without all of the dead ends."
The logo began to shimmer and shiver, the dots moving in rigid tiny jerks closer together, subtly rearranging themselves and overlapping, until what we were looking at was the reverse swastika with snakes that I had seen in the back of Serenity's yellow book.
"What is it?" Jilly asked, with a grimace of distaste.
"It's a clockwise swastika with yellow snakes," Harrison said in a stunned voice, and I felt his eyes like fingers on my face. "It's the symbol that was at the back of the book Serenity had under her bed, isn't it?"
I nodded. "And the one in the bus stop the woman said was the emblem of a gang in Shale Town. But what does it mean?"
I stared at the image on the screen again, feeling stupid with astonishment.
"The word swastika actually comes from a Sanskrit word, svasti, which means good fortune, but it can also mean resignation," Raoul said. "That's the meaning of this symbol under the snakes." He tapped the screen. "This is not the anti-clockwise version used by Hitler and his followers, which seems like it would be more appropriate, given what we have learned. This is a very ancient symbol that predates Hitler by literally thousands of years. The earliest known drawing is on a Paleolithic cave and is 10,000 years old. It was used by the Navajos in North America, too. The only other thing of interest is that in Buddhism, swastikas come in four different colors, and yellow represents infinite prosperity. Of course, this symbol might have no connection to what Race is doing, but it is hidden in his computer graphics, and given how your senses reacted to the possibility of Harlan seeing it, that suggests it's connected to both of them."
Raoul's voice trailed off significantly.
"Which means there must be a connection between Aaron Race and Harlan Sanderson," Harrison said.
"But how can there be?" I cried. "Aaron Race is a rich businessman. Why would he have anything to do with a gang of guys or some kid in school?"
"It's the sickness that connects them," Jilly said.
"It has to be. A sickness wouldn't care about age or wealth."
"But Aaron Race doesn't smell of the sickness," I protested.
"You think Aaron Race is infected, but fighting the sickness? Like Sari?"
Raoul shook his head and said, almost dreamily, "Actually, I've been thinking in a different direction completely. Remember the other day when Jilly asked what would ultimately happen to a person who was infected and didn't resist? Well, maybe it's like when an animal dies and rots. Bacteria begins to break the organism down, and there's an awful stink while that's happening. But once the process of corruption has run its course, there's no smell. In Aaron Race's case, he might smell of nothing because there's nothing left to be corrupted. Of course, it's not a physical sickness, so he doesn't die. His mind and body go on, but what was essentially him is gone."
"His soul," I thought.
"And you think he's trying to infect her, da?" Harrison asked. Raoul shook his head. "We think that Sari doesn't allow the sickness to become infectious, so she doesn't smell like Harlan or Dr. Austin. Taking into account how your senses are bothered by Race, I'd say he doesn't smell because he's gone beyond the capacity to infect."
"Then why is he always coming around?"
"I don't know, Alison, but try this on for a theory. He can't infect anyone, but he still has the same voracious drive to perpetuate the virus, so his desire to infect evolves or mutates into a desire to enable infection. He pointed to the logo, still glowing on the computer screen. I decided to check out a hunch once I saw that, and it wasn't hard to find out that Race Incorporated owns a printing press in Shale Town.
You think he's printing those books? Jilly whispered.
I'd bet my life on it, Raoul said calmly. I bet he's behind them, and the poetry group, which lures in discontented and spiritually wounded people who might be made vulnerable to infection. I'd guess the prepared victim would be presented to the gang, and somehow, whatever they do to him or her, enables infection by Harlan or others like him.
But how could Aaron Race do all that and not know he's infected? I asked.
Well, I think he would know he was infected by this stage, because in a way, all that would remain would be the virus in a human receptacle, Raoul said.
How does Alison Starr fit in, and all these artists and musicians whose lives Race messed with? Do you think they're all infected? Harrison asked.
I think the arts might be a good trawling ground for victims. A lot of painters and writers and musicians draw on their pain about the bad things that have happened to them when they create things.
You think he sets up the poetry group and it publishes those books and arranges charity functions and patronizes artists to give the virus more targets? Jilly said doubtfully.
There's no reason to suppose Race would not be as ambitious and creative and diverse in serving the virus as it would be as a successful businessman.
I thought of Gary Solomon telling me that Aaron Race was bad news for artists, that he altered and distorted their desires. I wanted badly to tell the others what the journalist had said, to see what they thought, but I kept coming up against Gary Solomon asking, "Are you a person who keeps promises, Alison White Star?"
"Maybe it's not your dad he's interested in, Alison," Jilly said suddenly. "Maybe he comes around to keep an eye on Serenity."
It made sense, especially when I remembered how eagerly Aaron Race had said her name the first time he came to the house. But in that case, why had he spent all that time talking to Da and inviting him to do gigs?
What I'd like to know is how Race came into contact with Harlan Sanderson, Harrison said. Do you think Race infected him before he stopped being able to infect anyone?
Raoul said, Harlan went to school in Shale Town, and Aaron Race was courting a wealthy widow there, so there is certainly a possibility that they might have met. He looked around and suggested we eat. I had no appetite, but it felt so sane and good to wash and shred lettuce and chop spring onions, and I realized Raoul had suggested eating as a way of drawing us out of the nightmare dimension we were creating with our speculations. Maybe that was why, when the lasagna and garlic bread came out of the oven, they smelled so wonderful. Once again, we ate at the jungle table. Raoul even insisted we light candles, and that reminded me of Jilly's gran talking about making things beautiful as a sort of response to all the ugliness of the world. By unspoken accord, we didn't talk about the virus. As we carried the plates back to the kitchen after the meal, we talked about trivialities, things in the paper and at the movies, and I had the odd feeling it must have been like that in wartime, before a battle, when there was no point in discussing the horror you were to face, because what was clear to me was that we were going to have to deal with what we were discovering, and that thought, when it came, terrified me more than everything else. As we loaded the dishwasher, Raoul told us the names of the directors of Orba were listed on the confirmation of acceptance he had been emailed, and he had noticed that Aaron Race's name was among them.
I'd say that's why Orba ended up funding residencies and running events at Castledean Estate.
So what are we going to do? Jilly asked suddenly. We have to do something about Alison's sister. She's obviously in danger.
Raoul nodded. Since we can't warn her that a boy at her school is trying to infect her with a sickness of the spirit, there's only one option, watching over her. Alison, do you know where she is now?
He directed this to me, and I nodded. She's sitting for my mother this evening.
Good. She's safe for tonight. But in future she must not be left alone if there's any chance she will go out. One of us must follow her.
Harrison said,
If I wanted to get her alone for a period without having to worry about anyone coming looking for her, I'd do it on Monday night, when she has an established pattern of being out late.
But what do we do if she does go somewhere after the poetry reading? Jilly asked.
Stop her, Raoul said grimly. And even though I think Harrison is right about the poetry group meetings, I think we still have to keep an eye on her at other times. That includes school hours, because Harlan might arrange for someone to draw her out at lunchtime or recess.
I bit my lip. Keeping tabs on Serenity would mean dealing with her fury if she spotted me tailing around after her, but Raoul was right. It had to be done.
Is it possible that infection isn't something that happens all at once? Jilly said hesitantly. Could there be something happening in those poetry groups that's a slow process of infection?
Raoul shook his head. Of course we don't know anything for sure. But I've been thinking about it, and from the little Sari has said, I'd say infection could occur all at once, like the laying of an egg. And if we're right about a person needing to be prepared to be infected, I'd guess that at the moment of infection or implantation, the spiritual wound that makes a person vulnerable to infection in the first place would need to be reopened or deepened.
As he spoke, he was getting a pile of different fruit from the fridge, and now he set us all to chopping it for a fruit salad. Peeling a kiwi fruit, Jilly said, Allison told us those guys who were with Harlan didn't smell infected. Why wouldn't they, if this virus is so hungry?
That's what makes me think infection cannot be a simple matter, especially if, as we have reasoned, the infected person does not know what they carry and must themselves be manipulated. Raoul said, Why else would Race set up such elaborate schemes? I think only certain types must be naturally vulnerable, and they have to be set up for it.
You think Alizon is that type? Harrison asked in disbelief.
We don't know what attracts the virus. It may be something quite random, like a certain scent or something else which we can't identify, Raoul answered.
I thought of the way the air churned between Race and Dar, and wondered if it was simply that the sickness in Race was drawn to something in Dar's scent, which it identified as a weakness. The ammonia scent or anxiety, maybe, or the smells which expressed his love for his family.
Raoul began to dish up fruit salad, and dimly I registered that the others were talking about how infection might take place. But I shut out their voices and focused on my train of thought, sensing that it was carrying me somewhere important. Aaron Race had stopped or altered the output of those artists he had been involved with. Was that because he wanted to infect them? Dar had said no one had a bad word to say about the entrepreneur, which in a world famous for its bitchiness, was itself worthy of note. Was it because Race was just setting the scene for infections, since he couldn't do the dirty work himself? But why artists? And why the distinct pattern of change in their work? I just didn't believe that it could be an accidental side effect, and such a fortunate side effect, because the dark stuff they produced after getting involved with Race was enough to wound anyone's spirit.
My mind made a quantum leap, and I stood up so abruptly that the chair I'd been sitting on crashed to the ground.
Oh, God, I whispered. I know what Aaron Race wants from Dar. He wants to change him so that he can use him, not as a carrier of the sickness, but as someone who can reach people, soften them up so that they're easier to infect. That's why he messes with all those artists. He uses them to help him enable infections. Some of them must work just fine as they are, ones like the Rack, who produce bleak, dark, hopeless stuff of their own accord. He'd only need to promote them and make sure people hear and see what they do. Maybe others are infected, and he'd use them in the same way, to spread despair and weaken the spirit as well as to infect. Then there would be others he just manipulates, until they're broken enough to produce the sort of art he wants from them. And the ones that won't change, he stops them working.
But your Dar won't change, Jilly said soothingly. He's too strong and kind and good.
I sat down, because of course she was right. Aaron Race had manipulated Dar, but he could not change Dar's essential nature. Put him with two confused and angry young rappers, and he would help them to build on their strengths and lift their spirits.
give him someone like Portia Sting, who was wounded in spirit, and his instinct was to heal them. I had a sudden vivid image of the way the air around Aaron Race bent inward while the air around Da pushed out. The first time I had noticed the effect, I thought it looked as if there were opposing forces. And now I saw that this was exactly what they were. Aaron Race carried a sickness that urged him to wound and break and darken people, and Da carried something that lifted and strengthened people. Jilly Harlan and I elected to walk from Raoul's house to Jilly's hotel because it was a bright, moonlit night and we were all full. We had agreed to meet later in the week after Daisy had come to look at his computer and see what she could learn about Aaron Race. Raoul's last words had been that we had to find some way to break Aaron Race's influence, since we could not go to the police. We needed to learn something about him that could be used against him, and maybe the activities of the Shaletown gang were his weak point. If we could establish a real connection between them, all we would need then is a way to publicize it. I had thought of Gary Solomon then, and told them I knew just how to get publicity if we came up with something. "No," Harrison said. "I was thinking that if you could point Harlan Sanderson out to me after school tomorrow, I can follow him and get his address. That's only if we didn't have to follow your sister," he added, looking at me. "There's a good chance you won't," I said. "Now that Mum has started painting her, she'll have to sit as often as possible. She'll probably go right home after school every night for the rest of this week. Mum's a pretty hard taskmaster." "Lucky for Serenity," Harrison said. We were passing a house where there was some sort of party going on. A man and a woman on the veranda suddenly hailed us in slurred, happy voices and invited us to join the party. We waved back half-heartedly and went on. "It's weird to think those people have no idea what's happening," Jilly murmured after we had gone another block. "They don't know about this sickness, and if we tried to tell anyone, no one would believe us. We're the only ones who know what's happening, and only Elizon and Sari can actually perceive it."
"Maybe there are other people who can see it too. Stands to reason," Harrison said, as we were approaching the entrance of Hotel Marceau.
"I won't tell Gran about Harlan," Jilly said, stopping a little way from the door to say goodbye. "There's no proof, and it's better for her to think the fire was random vandalism. Knowing that someone was deliberately setting out to hurt me would scare her, and she doesn't deserve that." Her eyes widened. "In fact, if I told her, I'd actually be weakening her spirit, wouldn't I?" Without waiting for an answer, Jilly turned and went into the gleaming foyer. I thought of what Jilly had said as we walked away. Then I said, "Not everyone set up for a victim would work out." Harrison looked at me in puzzlement. "I mean, they'd choose people who are spiritually weakened and prepare them, but at the last minute a person's spirit might rally and resist. I mean, if it's possible to resist it once you're infected, it must be possible to resist being infected."
"Except you wouldn't know you were being infected," Harrison pointed out.
"No, but there would have to be something going on that sort of mirrored the infection. Let's say the person brought in to be infected thought they were going to be tested or initiated into the gang, so something would be going on that would be intended to open them up and weaken them. But sometimes weak people become strong when they're in a bad way. They find reserves they hadn't ever known they possessed." Harrison was nodding eagerly.
"I know what you mean. I read a story in the newspaper just the other day about this 8-year-old laddie who'd walked miles with a broken arm to get help for his dad who'd been trapped in a fall. You'd ne'er think such a wee boy would be capable of so much bravery and endurance. I wonder what happens when someone doesn't work out."
I drew in a deep breath, thinking of Cole. Was that what was between him and Harlan? A fake gang initiation intended to mask infection which had gone wrong? A glimpse by Cole of something terrifying that had almost happened, then his subsequent withdrawal and a warning from Harlan to say nothing. We walked in silence for a while, then Harrison shot me a look. His face pale in the harsh spill of light from a street lamp.
"I didn't suppose..."
"What?"
"Well, I was just wondering if it might not be your sister who brought you there to Race's attention.
What if that flash drive Harlan gave you to return to your sister had your dad's song on it? Maybe she took it to that poetry group for some reason, and knowing Race's interest in celebrities, someone passed it on to him.
Why would Serenity talk about Da in a poetry meeting? I asked.
Well, you said yourself she's angry at him, and I bet there'd be every invitation and encouragement in those poetry meetings for people to wallow in all the negative things in their lives, Harrison said.
I shivered, because it seemed likely he was right.
Harrison shrugged off his coat and draped it around my shoulders. I didn't protest, and as his warmth and woody scent enveloped me, our gazes seemed to snag. Harrison took off his glasses very purposefully, and my heart began to hammer, because I thought he was going to kiss me again. Then a car roared by and blatted its horn at us, and he just polished the lenses and put the glasses on again.
"You shouldn't worry about your da, Alison," he said a few minutes later. "He's strong and broad, just like Jilly said. He's what a man ought to be, but my father decidedly is not."
The last words were muttered. I looked at him, screaming lightly enough that I could smell his sorrow.
"You have to be strong to live when someone you love has died. But my father wants to hide from all the disappointments and sorrows of his life. He doesn't get it that you kinda do that without blotting out all the good stuff as well."
He laughed harshly.
Couldn't help thinking of him tonight, when we were talking about artists painting pictures that took away hope, and musicians making music that grinds you into the ground. Maybe if there wasn't so much dreariness and despair in the world, a person like my father might have a chance to drag himself out of the pit.
"You're not like him," I said. Harrison gave me a searing look.
"No, I'm not. I didn't give in to despair. If the world went to hell in a handcart, I'd still fight and hope for better. I wouldn't care if there was no light or beauty. I'd remember the moments of beauty in my life, and I'd fight for the idea of them."
I was moved by his passion, and I wanted to tell him that I thought he had an unquenchable spirit, like Da. But the idea of putting such thoughts into words made me shy. So instead, I said, "I wish I was like you. But the truth is that I'm scared silly by all of this." Harrison fixed me with a determined look.
"I didn't think that feeling brave has very much to do with being brave. Anyway, you're not alone in this. I'm with you, and so are the others."
I laughed shakily. "For how long?"
"For as long as it takes, Alison. Forever, if that's how it comes out."
I stared at him incredulously, but there was nothing in his complex scent or pale eyes to make me doubt what he had said. He was quite simply vowing to help me fight the sickness for however long it took. It was like the sort of promise a hero might make to a princess in a book. And he meant it. Right then, the bus arrived, and by the time we had boarded and were seated, the strangely intense little exchange was left behind. A big rowdy crowd of people wearing rugby scarves and jumpers got on at the next stop, and the bus filled with the reek of sweat and alcohol and bursts of beery laughter. There was no use trying to talk. Watching the newcomers, I thought of the Shaletown gang and what a group of kids would be capable of doing that any one of them alone might balk at. The sickness would like groups, too, I thought. Again, I thought of Cole. Maybe instead of being a victim, he had just been one of the gang who, at some important moment, split away from the group mentality, refused to do something he was asked or ordered to do. The bus lurched up to the library stop, and Harrison pushed through the rugby people, towing me behind him by the sleeve of his coat. The moment we were off the bus, the hydraulics hissed and whined, and the bus wheeled away, leaving us in sudden and startling quiet. I tried to take off his coat to return it, but Harrison caught the collar to stop me and refastened the neck I had undone as if I were a child. I noticed that his eyes were more silver than grey in the fluorescent light of the bus shelter. Strange, beautiful eyes, I thought.
"Alison," Harrison began.
Then we both started violently as my bus lumbered round the corner. We laughed, and when I boarded a second later, I was still grinning. But as the bus moved off, I turned back and saw that Harrison was standing by the shelter, his hands hanging loosely at his sides, and suddenly I wasn't smiling. I sat back in my seat and admitted to myself that when he had been buttoning the coat up, I had wanted to kiss him. I could tell myself that it was just a residue of what he had poured into me that day in the meeting room at the library, but it would be a lie. I had liked that kiss, and I had wanted it again. And what would he have done if I had taken the initiative and kissed him? He had shoved us apart so hard that first time, and he was so careful not to touch my skin, as if he was making very sure that what had happened wouldn't happen again. Did that mean he hadn't liked it? But I knew that was not so. I had felt what he felt. I had felt desire. The woman in front of me began to laugh at something her companion had said, and the laughter scalded me. I scowled at the back of her head, telling myself that Harrison was a good friend and an ally, and I wouldn't be stupid enough to mess that up with some childish, misplaced romantic notions. Maybe it was that thought that made Harrison push me away. The woman rubbed at the back of her head, as if she felt my glare as a physical pressure. The rest of the way home, I thought about Gary Solomon. I had to go and see him as soon as possible, so that I could be freed of my promise, and also to set him up for when we needed someone to publicize what we found out about Aaron Race. I wished I could have wagged to meet him the next day, but I'd taken so much time off that the school might think of calling Da to discuss my attendance record. That left outside of school hours, but since I had to follow Serenity home, it could only happen after I got home. Maybe I could try to arrange an evening meeting in the mall, but it needed to be soon to take advantage of Serenity being tied up each evening, sitting for Mum.
37. Da hadn't arrived long before me when I got home. He smelled of the cold, clear night and second-hand cigarette smoke. He was heating soup, and Jessie was eating Vegemite toast, and they both looked surprised to see me.
"I thought you were going to call for a lift," Jessie said.
"Maybe she tried," Da said, glancing at the phone.
Miranda was on the stool, hunched around the phone like a tight comma, her voice low and tense, so that the words were inaudible.
"What's up?"
I asked quietly.
"Trouble in paradise," Jessie mouthed, rolling his eyes.
I shook my head. Miranda was forever getting mad about something and banishing Ricky from her presence, then summoning him tearfully back to apologize the next day or sometimes the next hour. Suddenly Miranda slammed down the phone and fled the room, banging the door behind her.
"Where's Serenity?" I asked.
Miranda's emotional storms were so common that it was hard to take them seriously.
"Still in the studio," Jessie said.
"How's the portrait going?" I took off Harrison's coat, then my blazer, and moved nearer the stove to get warm.
"Progressing, Zambia says,"
Da reported with a grin that reminded me Mum didn't like anyone seeing her work while it was in progress. He went on to ask if I wanted soup, and I refused, telling them with relish what I had eaten at Raoul's.
"He's quite a guy," Da said, with a teasing look.
For some reason, I thought of Harrison's silver-grey eyes and firm lips, and flushed.
Da looked delighted, and I had to say pointedly that Jilly thought he was quite a guy.
"Oh, Jilly," Jessie murmured, grinning in a way that made me want to slap him. But then everything we had figured out during the long night flooded into my mind.
"How was the rehearsal?" I asked Da, trying to sound casual.
"It was good, mostly," Da said, but he was frowning. "They're brilliant musicians, and we mesh fine musically, but less with some of the things they write about. I'm not their age, of course."
He sighed a little.
"Maybe anger really is part of youth. Maybe it goes with a natural desire of the young to break things, to supplant their elders, and to make something new of the world."
"I don't feel angry at anything," I said. "I don't want to break anything."
"Me neither," Jessie said mildly.
"Well, I didn't either as a lad," Da said, smiling at us both.
"But a lot of young people do, and that's the point. Neo-Tokyo songs are as legitimate a response to the world as my feeling of optimism. Problem is finding somewhere for those two views to meet."
"I think angry songs about wanting to smash things are just a negative and self-centered way to respond to the world," I snapped. "It's like a baby having a tantrum. When you hear that music, you feel angry and destructive too."
"Whoa," Da said, half laughing. "That's a fair bit of anger I'm seeing right now."
I forced myself to laugh, but I actually did feel angry at him. That he was voicing what sounded like uncertainty scared me. But I strove to collect myself. "I just feel like you have something unique to say, Da,"